Welcome to Scrappy ABM, your source for groundbreaking approaches that don't break the bank. ABM shouldn't cost $200K in tech to even get started. So if you want to get started with ABM or make your program even better without investing a massive amount of money, you're in the right place. Each week, we'll hear from the brightest minds in the marketing world who are redefining ABM, achieving incredible results with untraditional methods, limited resources, and a whole lot of creativity. This isn't a show about how much money you can spend on fancy tech or overhyped tools. Instead, it's about celebrating creative problem solving and the scrappiness it takes to get ABM right. We'll dive into how these marketing leaders built robust ABM strategies with limited resources, revealing the actionable insights that led to their biggest wins. So if you're a marketer ready to challenge the status quo and build a scalable, efficient, effective marketing strategy, Scrappy ABM is the show for you. So if you're ready to discover ABM strategies that are lean, impactful, and utterly transformative, let's dive into this episode.
Hey, what's going on, everyone? I'm Jason Hassenberg, and you're tuning into the Sour Go-to-Market SaaS Takes podcast, the show with sour takes and even sour candies. Mason Cosby's here to join us today. Mason, the founder of Scrappy ABM, possibly the scrappiest person I know to date. They're an agency focused on helping companies build their ABM strategy from the bottom up and also helping companies who already have an existing ABM strategy become more efficient with their spend and to be able to deliver revenue. Mason, thank you so much today for joining me on the show. Let's go ahead and open up that box.
Okay, well, I'm doing that. Jason, thank you for having me. I'm super pumped to see that this idea that you talked about actually came to life. So very excited to dig in. All right, box is open.
Come on.
All right, got some. Hold on. All right. How are we doing that? So we just pull it all out?
Yeah, pick it out. I'll tell you the five sour candies right now. So first sour candy we're going to try is sour Skittles. That's a level 9 on the Pucker Index. So that's going to be the lowest sour level. We're going to start with the low tier and move up higher. Second candy is going to be the Warhead Sour Popping Candy. That's a level 24. Yep.
Okay.
Third's going to be the Crybaby Tears. That kind of looks like tears, if you see. Yes. That is a Pucker Index of 34. The next candy we're going to do is Barnett's Mega Sour Candy. It's the biggest candy you got in there. That's a Pucker Index of 40. And then the last but not least, the Toxic Waste Nuclear Fusion. That one's a level 43. It's going to get crazy in here. It's going to get sour. Going to have real sour takes. Mason, are you ready to go?
No. Because there was not a big jump from 40 to 43. Sounds like the tail of this is going to be awful.
Yeah, the first three are okay, but they get you ready for the last two. And I'm not going to tell you how it goes because you're just going to have to figure that out yourself, man. So,
all right,
getting into it, your first sour take, let's go ahead and get our sour Skittles ready. As I will say your sour take, let's just put them in our mouth. Here we go. Mason, you sent over five sour takes to me. Your first sour take. Most organizations are starting with ABM entirely in the wrong way. Love to hear your opinion on this.
All right. Well, I'm chewing some sour Skittles. There's a lot of reasons that people get ABM wrong. Three main ones. We'll talk about some of them later. The main thing to focus in on here. So most people, actually, I wouldn't say even most. A lot of organizations do think, though, when we go to build an ABM program, like have to have the right technology in place. Even as of the recording today, I posted about it. You see, okay, we're going to build an ABM program. That's one of the only strategies, to my knowledge, that we actually use the language sometimes of like, I'm going to go buy ABM. Nobody buys inbound. Nobody buys outbound.
Yep.
Nobody buys content marketing.
Yep.
You like invest in content marketing with the right people and the right processes. But I've heard it said from a lot of different people, oh, we went and bought ABM.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they managed to buy a platform. But when you do the platform first as opposed to the strategy first, and it's talked about frequently, you're just gonna fail. They're gonna fall right on your face. And even some tech vendors will say, oh, you need the right strategy, but the strategy has to be tech enabled. And it's just simply not the case. Like you can start, I built a company around this. You can start scrappy with what you have today to actually prove the model. And once you've proven the model and your framework, you can then actually implement technology that equips you to scale it. But I'm just a huge fan of running an ABM program with like one marketer and one seller to prove out the model in a very controlled and contained way. And once you've proven out that model, then rolling it out across the sales team, rolling out new technology to scale it up. But I don't hear it talked about often enough. ABM should really start with like one marketer, one, two, maybe three sellers in a very small and controlled and contained way.
Let me ask you this as a follow-up question. Why do you think people are jumping ahead to the tech stack right away and not laying into the strategy?
Largely silver bullets. Most people are looking at ABM and it's the idea on the surface is probably very appealing specifically to sales leaders and a lot of executive leadership because for still so many executive leaders, they don't understand the impact of marketing. They don't understand the impact of brand. They just think, okay, we should actually go and run a sales program. Oh, that happens to have marketing involved. So that's where a lot of people are starting with ABM. And because there's this silver bullet mentality of, oh, if we build an ABM program, we'll actually get marketing to do stuff for revenue, not just like fluffy brand stuff. What ends up happening is the sales leader actually is the one that may lead the charge on ABM or the CEO. And when you Google ABM and not doing a ton of research into it, the largest companies that actually have a presence around the topics are the tech vendors that are then telling you exactly how to run it. So they're doing a great job on the tech vendors are doing a great job on a marketing front. And this is slowly starting to change. More tech vendors are disqualifying earlier, but I think it's put a really bad taste in people's mouth because they were selling to anybody versus people that were ready.
That's a really good take right there. And I think one thing I'd love to highlight is, breaking it down from, like, let's say a startup who's trying to get into the SaaS, like real small startup SaaS, and they're trying to break through. They want to run an ABM strategy, right? How would you break that down compared to a, let's say, a, 200 person company or maybe a 500 person company? How would you break those strategies down differently?
I'm going to steal a book or steal a page out of Sangram's newest book, Move. So Sangram outlines that there's three stages to go-to-market maturity. So the first is what is referred to as problem market fit. So it's identifying, do we have a viable enough problem to even solve that we can build a sustainable business for a market? So first, very problem focused. The next we product market fit. I don't think that any company pending a future take, but any company pending a future take, I don't think should actually be running an ABM program until they have product market fit because you don't know the industry that you actually solve the problem for best until you've had enough reps and actually selling that you know the industry that you serve incredibly well and that your product fits that specific market. So I would actually say if you're too early stage from a startup perspective, you're likely like prime example, I am technically a startup because we're a bootstraps organization that's been existing for about 6 months. I'm not running an ABM strategy personally because I am figuring out the right product market fit for my services and the approach that we take to the right industry. Once I know that industry and the vertical that I serve incredibly well, I will then build an ABM program to serve that vertical.
I love that. That's a great take right there. And that leads us to our second sour take, Mason. So we're going to be trying now the Warhead Sour Popping Candy. Pucker Index is a 24. Here we go.
That's a
Let's
jump.
up. That's a
That's a
jump
we
right
went from
there.
9 to 24.
It's definitely a jump. For some reason, this packaging isn't open, so I'm going to bite it. So as we put this in our mouth, I'm just going to read out the second sour take. Most
All right.
organizations should start their ABM program focused on customer expansion. Mason, let's dig deep into this one here.
Well, for starters, I thought the Skittles were worse. The Pucker Index is totally wrong on this one. Maybe I just ate it too quickly. This was actually pleasant. No, so for again, thinking through What's the concept of account-based marketing?
Yeah.
The concept of account-based marketing is a growth strategy that is focused on your best fit potential customers. There's an exponentially greater likelihood that you know who your best fit potential customers are if they are already your customers than if they are prospects.
Okay.
And for a lot of organizations, they do not have any programming outside of like their CSMs begging for a renewal. They don't actually have a sustainable program around how do we renew our customers.
Yep.
And let's forget expansion. We're not even thinking through how do we expand this customer base. So I feel like every company talks about, oh, I've got this land and expand program, but in reality, it's just I land the client and I'm really thankful, and I never actually think about the long-term expansion impact. So an ABM program, starting with your existing customer base, you know the accounts, you know the decision makers, you likely know a lot of the pain points because they are actively telling you what their pain points are that you're
Yep.
already trying to solve for them. So it just makes so much sense to start there to build the ABM model, because if you think about what goes into an ABM program, I'm going to quickly outline for Scrappy ABM, we have this framework called the four Ds.
Love it.
We have desire, we have data, we have distribution, we have destination. So again, from a desire perspective, what's the goal of the campaign that we're going after? In this context, would be to expand our customer base.
Okay.
Data, who are we going after from a targeting perspective? And what data do we have on them that actually triggers an informed, personalized outbound and ABM program? So again, data, you should have the best data on your existing customer base, hypothetically. So you already are eliminating one of the core three challenges for building an ABM program, because you likely have existing great data on your customers, certainly better data than you have on prospects,
True.
which then moves into distribution. What are the channels we have access to? Well, email open rates are exponentially better when you are an existing customer because you already know the company and you already have some level of implicit trust. So you have better distribution channels than in any other kind of an ABM program that you could run because, again, they already know you, they already trust you. And
True.
hypothetically, if you're a SaaS platform, they are likely in your technology every day or every week. You have in-app notifications. You can literally send them direct messages or direct notifications or banners within a platform. That is a distribution channel that you have for no other potential ABM program. So there's more access to higher converting distribution channels within your customer base. And lastly, destination. Where are we trying to point them towards? Again, you can build out specific dedicated use case landing pages around customers that are using this product that moved into this product saw exponentially greater success.
Okay.
You can create the 1 + 1 = 3 story for your customers.
Yep.
And again, you have the distribution channels that then make the actual destination, the content of where you're sending them, work exponentially greater. And the other thing is you can showcase like customers to like customers way more easily, because if you are building the program correctly, let's say you're a software company that's dedicated to the restaurant industry. You build a number of case studies of the restaurants that worked with you, not just on the one product that was your land product, but
Yeah.
they worked with you on four different products that were your expand products. And you showcase the story and you help people understand. And then you schedule time and say, hey, on our next monthly touch point, I'd love to dig into a lot of these products with you. And again, prime example. And I know that I'm super small. I am very insignificant for a lot of people from an ACV perspective at Scrappy ABM. My customer success managers are largely never reaching out to me. I'm reaching out to them. They are not success managers, they are service managers. So success is making sure that the customer is successful and stays with you longer term. To be successful, you should probably be reaching out to me more than 2 months before our renewal. You should be reaching on out to me and being a part of the life cycle throughout the entire journey.
That's
So
so
that's like my maybe hot take, spicy sour take. But I think if you build an ABM program that involves your customer success managers, you're going to have an exponentially greater result identifying and building out the framework.
yeah.
And then you take that same framework and implement it in pipeline. And then once you've nailed it in pipeline, you go out for completely net new business, because it becomes exponentially more difficult from a data and distribution perspective the further up funnel you go.
Let me ask you this too, as a follow-up question. When did you come up with the idea of creating Scrappy ABM, right? And how did you know you're like, this really needs to be done?
I came up with the idea of Scrappy ABM because I made a post about a program that I had run through LinkedIn that was free LinkedIn, and I was able to generate about $1 million in revenue for the company that I was working for at the time through LinkedIn and podcasting. It was like what I referred to as my
Badass.
$32 tech stack. From there, when I talked about if you're building a scrappy ABM program and the post, I have posts that go and do well.
Yeah.
But if I'm being entirely honest, a lot of my posts that do really, really well are like personal posts. They're more motivational than like tactical information.
Sure.
People still like the tactical information, but like this was one of the first posts that really took off that was tactical, practical information on how to actually build something
Yeah.
and got like a ton of engagement, got a ton of comments. I actually people reach out and say, like, I love this concept. Do you do any kind of consulting or freelance work? Because I was working
Okay.
full time at that point. And I was like, oh, this has got some legs. So then I Googled Scrappy ABM. I was like, surely I'm not the first person to put those two words together. And the first search result 2 days after I made the post was the post that I had made. So I was like, cool,
Yeah.
I'm gonna try to own this concept. So I
Yeah.
launched a podcast and said, like, I'm gonna take on a couple of clients here and there. And then the podcast really took off. And then I ended up closing two or three clients. And then from there, it just kind of continued to grow. So that was how the inception of Scrappy ABM came to be,
Yeah.
was I was just talking about essentially the way that I run ABM because I've always been a very low tech marketer and a very solo. I'm primarily been a solo marketer my entire career. So when you're low tech plus solo, you got to get scrappy. And I always loved the concept of account-based marketing. So that's how Scrappy ABM came to be.
It's funny because I feel like in the SaaS industry, these SaaS companies, because they're in the tech industry, it's like, oh, we have to have the most expensive tech stack, right? And I'd love to hear from your point of view, from the customers you've had over the course of, the couple of years you've been in business, what have been some of their biggest problems that you've seen, and how have you helped them and fixed that?
Yeah, I mean it's largely biting off more than you can chew.
Okay.
So again, we'll going back to this first take of let's go buy the tech stack. I mean, onboarding a new piece of software is often not a small undertaking,
Sure.
especially if you have existing software. So you've got to figure out your CRM integrations. You've got to figure out the appropriate flow of data. You have to make sure that by integrating the software, you're actually not going to completely screw up your data. So like prime example. I bought a data enrichment platform that integrates into my CRM. And anytime I like do some level of any task associated with one of the people in my data enrichment and outbound software, it then automatically integrates into my HubSpot instance. And on HubSpot, I am charged on a per contact basis. So
Okay.
again, if it's pushing over to HubSpot, if I don't set up my HubSpot instance appropriately with that integration sync, it's going to dramatically drive up my costs.
Okay.
And
Yeah.
like, those are just like very practical things that are like financially related. So that's how you get finance on board, is making sure you don't dramatically drive up your costs. But then also just from a data cleanliness perspective, like if you just suddenly open up the floodgates and you have a ton of new data from a
Yep.
new source flooding into your system and you haven't accounted operationally for how that data will be organized and where it should live within your CRM, or if it should live in your CRM, like thinking through all of those things, you're just going to really mess up the data side, which
Yeah.
then makes it exponentially more difficult for marketing to provide actual information to sales, which is then when sales gets really frustrated and it's like, this is a bunch of garbage because you've overwhelmed the system with not appropriately organized information.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great ending to our, I would say, our next sour take, Mason. Thanks so much for that in-depth talk about ABM and what you're seeing in the market. I think it'll be very helpful for the people watching this show. So let's move on to the sour take number three. Cry baby tears. Let's hope that this is more sour than our second one here.
Should have untwisted all of these before we started.
I twisted them too hard, I think, when I packaged these myself. So
Okay, here we go.
I'm gonna take all four. You don't have to.
No.
Totally up to you. All right. The current lack of alignment between marketing and sales is largely because it mar is largely marketing's fault. Let's dive into this one.
Okay. But now I'm really worried for these last two. Because that one, it was like a step up.
Yeah.
Wasn't terrible, though. I'm like,
This next one you're gonna hate.
I will probably. So, why do I think the lack of alignment between marketing and sales is largely marketing's fault? I think the reason that people loved ABM is, again, it aligned the concept that marketing and sales would actually be on the same same team, same page. And I also think it's hilarious that there's been a rise of the concept of a revenue marketer. Like, what are you doing? Like, what else would you be doing? So don't get me wrong, like, I recognize that there is a ton, a ton, a ton of value in brand. And I've started to say this of like, I'm an EBMer in my mind, but I'm a brand marketer at heart. Like, I'm wearing a branded sweatshirt with a branded hat, and like, I have a branded neon sign. Like, I recognize there's massive value in brand, and it's difficult to track and attribute,
True.
but that should be like 20% of what you're doing, not 80. And I think what a lot of marketers were doing is very difficult to track. Not clearly aligned to revenue. And again, in an organization that where revenue is the lifeblood, if you're not talking about how the impressions actually tie back to actual true long-term business metrics, then it's not super helpful. So again, I think that marketing talks about things for so long that just genuinely don't matter, that as a result, sales kind of wrote us off and was like, I mean, you see the funny videos from people like Ross, that's corporate bro, that is literally like, marketing is just sitting there drinking their kombucha, and then sales is actually doing the work. And so I think that, again, as we think back on what marketing has largely been doing, it's these large scale events, it's these brand activations, and it's like this really nice feel good stuff where it's like, look at our social engagement, look at how much that's increased. No, wrong. Again, as a marketer, I understand the value of that. But also, as somebody that is now directly associated with revenue as a founder and has been in a sales role previously, connecting the impression on LinkedIn to a tangible outcome of people are actually booking calls on our website because they followed us on LinkedIn for 6 months. A lot of marketers are not making those connections. I also largely think, depending on the organization, it's because you're so channel specific that you can't think holistically, but that's another hot take for or sour take for another time. I think that, again, sales very focused, very central on like, we book meetings, we run a discovery call. Marketing, it's so broad and it's so difficult for another organization to fully understand, but I still put it on marketing because we talked about the wrong things for so long and we haven't given the full picture in a way that's easier to understand.
It's funny you say that because I feel like attribution has been, the name of the game for the last year, especially for marketers trying to attribute what they're actually doing. How is it bringing revenue in? And being a community manager now at Sales Intel, it feels like I've had multiple calls with sales reps who are on LinkedIn who are trying to get social but don't really know how to handle it. And I think that's one of the best ways to actually bring alignment is to show your sales team like, hey, we could actually use social to and use it in a way to create meetings if we're engaging with our content. So just from your standpoint, if you're talking to a company and they're wondering, how do we bring the two together? How do we Dream Data probably is one of my favorite examples of marketing and sales alignment, right? So from your standpoint, what do you think in terms of that?
I think what Dream Data, if we're going to use this example, does incredibly well is they have a massive amount of respect and understanding for the role of the other part. So, prime example, Laura is so actively involved in the marketing from a seller's perspective that she is often mistaken as a marketer at Dream Data. Like,
True.
and again, like their alignment is a prime example because clearly Laura's doing sales. Clearly, the rest of the marketing team is doing marketing, but Laura is an active part of the marketing team. The marketing team is an active part of the sales team because they are so well integrated. The other thing that I want to directly address is it is easier for there to be sales and marketing alignment in a SaaS company that is a marketing technology or a sales technology.
True.
Because again, in that context, if you're marketing a sales technology, sales is your ICP. So there's
True.
clearly going to be a massive amount of respect for sales and understanding your ICP and their challenges, and then incorporating that in your marketing. If you're selling a marketing technology, you want to understand your buyers, which are marketing people. and they know the ICP better. So honestly, marketers in a lot of MarTech companies are salespeople in disguise anyway, and they're just networking, which is great. It's much more difficult in a technology. Like we're working with some clients that are in the manufacturing space.
Okay.
Like their buyers aren't on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Their sellers don't necessarily have a respect for marketers. So again, what we're doing in that context is focused on very short-term small projects that force marketing and sales to actually work together.
I
So that
love it.
once you've actually done that, you can prove out some wins and you get sales buy-in.
Yep.
And sales comes back and says, this little thing that we did, this was freaking awesome. We got like another 50 meetings on the calendar for this month because we did this little program together. Couple of examples, like running a closed loss program with sales that actually gets meetings back on the calendar, running a customer win back program, running a missed meeting program, running a they hit the product, the pricing, and the demo page, and they didn't book a call. Like those are programs that you can run using your existing data or a couple of free tools that you install on your website that then deliver right fit accounts back to sales in an automated and segmented way. So when you start with something like that, that takes marketing 30 to 45 days to put together, and then sales can run it on an ongoing basis. You've now created the buy-in from sales to actually care about what marketing is doing and want to get involved. And as a result, you're aligned.
When the teams align, it's a beautiful thing, right? When the teams aren't aligned, it feels like everything's going to shit, right? And so when you're with these companies, right? And let's just be honest, a lot of them, they start off, they're like, well, marketing, it's marketing's fault, sales fault, revenue isn't, it isn't being impacted the way it needs to be. Is there some sort of conversation you're having up front with these companies that you're working with? Like, hey, we need to kind of make something happen here. We need to be aligned. I'd
Yeah.
love your opinion.
I always ask, is there one salesperson? Like, is there one salesperson that shows a little bit more interest in marketing and would be open to doing an experiment with us?
Cool.
You don't need everybody. Like, you need one. And if you can get one seller on board, awesome. You're golden. And
Yeah.
I want to be super clear, this doesn't necessarily even like you need sales leadership buy-in, but it doesn't super work as well if it's a sales leadership directive.
Okay.
That's like just essentially says, hey, we're going to sacrifice the seller to the marketing team, and they're just going to do whatever marketing says. Because then at that point, everyone's doing it reluctantly, or to like try to keep the peace internally from a political perspective. Like, you need a seller that is interested, that wants to learn more, that ha has a real hunger, essentially. And the way that I look at that, it was actually really interesting. I'll share a quick story of somebody that used Sam McKenna's framework of Show Me, You Know Me. That was an SDR. And they were an SDR that got put on a PIP. And they were said, or they were told, you've got 3 months to turn this around,
Wow.
or you're going to get let go. So he said, and I quote, I was doing what they were telling me to do, and it wasn't working. So I figured, what else do I have to lose? I'll do something that they aren't telling me to do and see if it works. And it worked. He hit 180% of his quota that quarter because he got really personalized and very specific and very targeted in his outbound messaging, as opposed to sending 300 emails and 100 dials a day. So again, as you're looking at your ABM program, there's two places I would look. Who's at the very bottom of the leaderboard? Who has literally nothing to lose? Like, worst case scenario, they already sucked and you
Yeah.
didn't help them at all. They were already on the chopping block. Best case scenario, if you can turn around the worst seller
Yeah.
and actually make them into a mid-tier seller, you've worked wonders.
Yeah.
The other approach that works really, really well is people that are consistently hitting their quota. So they've already hit it, they're already happy, they're already good. At that point, they're like, sure, I'll help out with something else because I've already done my job. So they're a little bit more less stressed. The challenge with going after the middle of the pack type people is what they're doing currently is already working enough
Yeah.
that they're not super stressed out, but they're stressed out enough that they don't want to change the process.
It's funny because you said you kind of have to work from the bottom, find those leaders at the bottom and work your way up. Because if you take a low tier seller, right, and you make them into a mid tier, maybe even one of the best sellers in the team, obviously everyone on the team is going to look and say, what the heck are you doing, right? How are you hitting these numbers when you were just on a PIP 3 months ago. And so when that does take place and the leadership is looking, have you seen that? Has that happened for some of the projects you've worked on? And what does the leadership say to you when they see this result?
There's one specific client that was one of my really, so again, Scrap Heap has existed for 6 months. So some of the stuff, though it takes 30 to 45 days to implement, it takes a quarter to see the real results. So one of my first clients actually has come back around and is like, we loved what you were able to accomplish. So again, they B2C and B2B business, their B2B sales team, we built an outbound sequence that's based on the B2C data that they were able to capture. And they were starting to set an additional 9 to 15 meetings a week through that outbound cadence. Wow. So again, it's great to get meetings, but what they were already starting to see is because people had brand familiarity, they already saw the value because they were a B2C customer and a much lower value thing. They were then able to bring it into their organization. So again, their meetings were actually closing at a higher deal conversion than their other standard outbound programs. So they've come back around and said, we want to build a fuller program with you.
Yeah.
So again, what we're seeing is when you build a simple playbook that is not overly complex, but accomplishes the goal, which is how do we get more meetings on the calendar? How do we convert more of these deals? What that turns into is you get the buy-in to go build bigger.
Yep.
So that's why, again, I think people, if we go back to the first take, I think they're building it wrong because they try to build the big thing first with the massive tech stack. And instead, start with what you have today, prove out something, make a win, and then build on top of that.
When a new hire comes in, let's say a new, you know, VP of marketing or director of marketing comes in and they're like, all right, they're given the task to create the new playbook, right? You see it all the time. It's a huge playbook. It's 200 pages long. What would be your advice to that new, you know, head of marketing, or how would you advise them to go about their, you know, first 30 days when building out the plan?
In a past job, I had a great boss that I would build out these really big really big presentations on, like, this is our monthly marketing strategy update. And like, here are all the things that we're doing. Here's all the stuff. And she inevitably said to me, Mason, I just need one page. I need a one-page marketing plan. Like, I'm glad you put together 50 slides. It's a waste of your time. Like, I know this took a lot of time.
Yeah.
And we don't have the resources for you to take this much time. Mm-hmm. I need a page. Like, what are we doing this month? One page. What you get?
Yep.
I was like, okay, cool, 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 cool. So then it took my, like, planning and my documentation of what we were doing from, like, 3 days. Of like mapping everything out, get done in 2 hours. It's just like a one-page marketing plan. So like, again, early, as you grow, as your organization grows and your marketing maturity grows, there will be more sophistication to it.
Yeah.
What I think is a problem is people want to be sophisticated when they haven't done the fundamentals. They haven't done the basics.
Yeah.
Again, I keep talking about automating your closed loss program. That should not be revolutionary. But I have yet to meet somebody that has done it.
Yeah.
I've had like 100 conversations in the past 3 months. Everybody knows they need a closed loss program. No one has built out their repeatable program around it. They just think about it at the end of the quarter and they're like, oh yeah, we should do that.
Yeah.
And they haven't systematized it. They're just like, oh, we could do that. Like, we should re-engage our lost deals, as opposed to creating a coordinated program around marketing and sales actually aligning on that. So that's a one-page marketing plan. If you did a one-page marketing plan every single month and said, like, what are the things that are currently running that we're going to continue to sustain? What are the cool things that we're going to start to try to build out in an MVP type model of like a minimum viable product? Like, what are we going to test this month and just see if it works? If you did that every single month, you would actually have, one, buy-in, because people would actually read it and check it out.
True.
Two, you would have a simplified approach of actually measuring the progress from a program perspective. Are you, in a single page, changing the program and iterating on it every single month and optimizing it every single month? Or are you completely changing the playbook every month? Because if you're completely changing the playbook, either you're a wrong fit for the organization, you need to leave anyway, or you aren't letting things actually run for even a quarter to see if they're going to work. So I just think, stop making these massive decks, make a one-page marketing plan, simplify it down so you actually get buy-in and people understand what you're doing and why you're doing it.
I love it. And before we go to sour take number four, because I had a question pop up in my mind that to me seems tricky, but maybe you have the answer. for companies that are going through like a rebranding, right? How are you going about the ABM program, right? When you're rebranding Comsore, right? They rebranded a little bit. So think about that. How would you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think about a rebrand of why are we rebranding? So often it's to reposition within the market and reposition within our industry. So again, from a rebrand, like why? So I think then it really is actually a brand activation campaign, because as much as I love ABM, as I love talking about revenue-based marketing, people cannot buy from you if they don't know that you exist. So if you change your name, there's pros and cons to it, obviously. But the biggest con is you have to then re-educate people on who you are and that you exist.
Yep.
So if you're doing a rebrand and like a pure play rebrand where you're like changing everything, the name, everything, then it's a brand activation campaign towards your target accounts to make sure that they know that you exist. And you're kind of like, it's not a full restart from a funnel perspective, but like they are super top of funnel because they're not Googling you anymore. And granted, yes, there's company redirects, not like that, they'll find you, but it's the most top of funnel. And then once they made the connection, they'll probably reappear back in where they were from a funnel perspective of their journey. But you've got to do the top of funnel, like make people super aware that you changed your company name and what you're doing and your position to the market.
So after that brand activation is really when you would start carrying out, you know, your ABM, and okay, that makes sense to me. Let's move on. Sour take number four. Now, this has been voted the most sour candy out of the five. So get ready. It's our Barnett's Mega Sour Candy, level 40. I have it out. Let me know when you're ready. This one I'm going to cheers you on. Let's do it. ABM should be the only marketing strategy for vertical SaaS companies.
Oof. I have a side note. For anybody on this, show, the tactic you should use is chewing. Don't suck. Just eat it. But I'm done with that sour candy.
Wow.
Boom. We're done. All right. I didn't even taste it. Actually, I did. That was pretty bad. Okay, so ABM should be the only strategy for vertical SaaS. So if you think about this, what is the core of account-based marketing again? B2B growth strategy that aligns marketing and sales around a set of shared target accounts. I am not a vertical SaaS or vertical specific company. I'm a problem specific company. I help B2B companies focus on building the right foundation for their marketing program. I work with event companies. I work with SaaS companies. I work with manufacturing companies. And I will probably initially or inevitably niche down further. But for right now, I'm problem specific.
Okay.
I've talked to companies that are dedicated to helping specifically customer success teams of recurring revenue business models in the tech space identify and analyze churn with an AI tool. That's a list that you can make.
Yeah.
Like it's not huge. It's not crazy. Because I remember when I was working at a company that specifically and exclusively targeted B2B tech. I don't think B2B tech necessarily is a small enough. Like, yeah. I think that's pretty massive. But if you target B2B tech, it's like 30,000 companies.
At least.
In the grand scheme of things, if you have like a large enough a large enough sales team, you could actually break that down into like specific account lists that sailors can run with.
Mm-hmm.
But especially, I'm working with some companies right now, their total world of accounts is 1,000 accounts. They are a mortgage identity verification software. There are only so many banks in the US that are at the size and scale of what they can serve. It is literally 1,000. That is a small enough list. There's a small enough pool of accounts that why would you run anything else? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because you are so specific, so niche, so targeted, and you know who they are. You can partner with your sales team. If you had 10 sellers and you had 1,000 accounts, that's 100 accounts a seller. That's not crazy. You can only have five sellers. It's 200 accounts per seller. That's not crazy.
Not at all.
And then you just build a program in which they are specifically focused on being the educational guide that helps these companies understand the value. So you're not being a hard sell seller. And I think hard sell sellers are often coming from a place where they have too many people to go after, and they're just trying to see what fast wins they can get. If you're vertical SaaS and you only serve so many accounts, you know exactly who you can serve. So you have to create the best reputation to best serve those customers. Because if you ruin your reputation in that industry, you know, in 1,000 accounts that you could go after, and your reputation's ruined, you're done.
Yeah, you're done.
So again, I think if you think about how large is our pool of accounts that we can even go after, if it's 1,000, because you're super specific from a vertical SaaS perspective, then don't be hard sellers. Be helpful guides that guide your customer into understanding the value that you specifically provide, how you make their life better, and understanding why you are uniquely qualified to serve them as their provider of choice. That is a very different playbook than the cold outbound plus inbound type program. So again, I just think it's not talked about. I've never seen anybody else talk about that as a thought process.
Yeah.
But again, vertical SaaS, super specific by its nature. Just be really targeted and specific in who you're going out to.
How are you incorporating, let's say, LinkedIn into, and maybe they're not on LinkedIn, but let's just say the vertical SaaS company, who they're targeting is on LinkedIn. So how do you
Yeah, it's a great question. So you can obviously create a list that is very specific to these are the right decision makers at these companies that we want to go after. So you can go connect with all your target accounts on LinkedIn and actually engage them through the content that you're creating. You can engage with them on their content. And again, the whole goal is simply showing up consistently and being a valuable, helpful resource that they can't ignore you. Most of the accounts that I've closed are people that have just engaged with my content. I've engaged with their content for literally years. And now they're my partners because they're a client. So, like, again, I knew the reputation that I would hold as an individual within my market. And I took an account-based approach to making sure that I built great relationships with the key players within the industry. And as a result, they're now my clients, or they're my referral partners, or they're my tech partners, or whatever that needs to look like. So again, very specific on who am I within the industry? How do I then represent myself well on LinkedIn to my target accounts within the vertical that I want to serve? And then how do I essentially befriend the right individuals from a relationship perspective?
Following up with that, I was just talking to Melissa Gaglione, and she was talking about how a lot of, marketing teams and sales teams, they'll have specific layouts like, okay, you're going to connect with this person on day one, and you're going to send an email day three, and then you're going to go and comment. What's your belief there? How do you structure out that sort of movement so that it doesn't feel just like plain Jane, right?
Great question. Native in-platform capabilities of putting the notification bell on your right fit customers so that you're showing up in a timely fashion whenever they've actually posted. And again, I'm less concerned about did I like the comment on day three of our outbound sequence? And I'm more concerned with am I showing up whenever they're showing up in a way that actually is supportive and contextual to what they have put out. Now, that's also very different in the event that somebody doesn't post on LinkedIn a lot. A
Yeah.
playbook that I hear that I think is really, really successful, I've started to do it myself, or for accounts that are not super active on social from a posting perspective, they may be active in what they're liking. So I go follow the people that my target accounts are following, and I show up frequently from a commenting perspective so that I'm top of mind for my accounts.
I love that idea. That is super smart. And who did you learn that from?
Sam McKenna, Matt Green, Jen Allen, somebody,
Yeah.
Will Aiken. It was one of those four. I can't remember exactly who.
That's incredible. Mason, I thank you so much for that sour take number four. We're gonna dive into now sour take number five, the most sour candy in this list. Supposedly, some people don't think so, but let's see your opinion here. Toxic waste, nuclear fusion, the number 43. This one is a little bit more impactful, not right off the bat.
Oh, it's got
Cheers
a
to
slow
you.
burn.
It's a slow burner. Here we go. The best low-cost ABM playbook is per peer lead influencer marketing.
Okay. So peer-led influencer marketing.
Yeah, peer-led influencer marketing.
So, for example, you know, I love the podcast LinkedIn playbook. But if I'm a marketer selling to CFOs and I'm the marketer that hosts the podcast, it's very clearly a marketing tool. It's very clearly a business development tool. It is not a peer-to-peer conversation. It's not a relationship builder. If people come on the show at all, it's a transactional approach, which is why I really love the peer-to-peer aspect. Because when I was a marketer in a marketing agency, I was allowed into marketing communities where I could speak to my target accounts, and the salespeople were not. So again, recognizing that when you're a peer, you are allowed into more intimate settings than other people are. Another prime example, this is not to call out CMO Coffee Talk, but like I've applied to be in CMO Coffee Talk. I have not been allowed in CMO Coffee Talk because I am not a CMO. Yeah. I'd love to be in CMO Coffee Talk. I've gotten plenty of referrals from CMO Coffee Talk, which is awesome. And I'm trying to get in there to get more, but that's why I'm not allowed in. I'm using it as a referral tool and to generate new business as opposed to maintain the relationships that are part of that community. So again, when you're a peer and you show up consistently and you actually are around your target accounts and you develop relationships with your target accounts, it's exactly how you break into a deal really quickly. Like prime example, when I launched Scrappy ABM, I went to a few of my friends that were CMOs that were at my target accounts that were right fit customers. And I said, hey, I'd like to help you build your ABM program. They're like, cool. We know you, we trust you. Let's do it. They signed the contract in 2 days. So like, it's just because it was peer led, because I've created a small personal brand and people generally speaking, I've put it this way, because I am not important in the grand scheme of things, but I would say I'm really, really important to like 5,000 people total. Like, and in that group of 5,000 people, there is some level of trust.
I'm one of them.
So again, you're kind to say that, but we'll use you as an example. Like, let's say you're at Sales Intel and you need support in building an ABM program. I am likely on the short list of people that you would call. Yep. Doesn't mean I'm going to necessarily guarantee a win, but I'm on the short list of people that you would trust to even explore the conversation. Yep. So because I have done a peer-led influencer play within my target accounts, I'm on their short list and they're coming to me when they actually need support. And I think it costs me $0 other than my time. So again, if you can find a peer that is actively engaged in the communities that you have your target accounts engaging in, it is the low cost way that you can actually break into any account. Because the other thing, and go look up this video that Will Aiken posted where Will is doing cold calls. I've called out Will on like 4 podcasts this week. Apparently he's doing great work. All that to say, he cold called somebody and he said, hey, this is Will Aiken. And the dude on the other end of the line started freaking out. He was like, wait, you're Will Aiken? I love your content. You're amazing. I can't believe you just called, and like started losing his mind and got so pumped he was cold called by Will Aiken. Like, that is how, another prime example, Sanger Verge, mass amount of respect. Anytime he emails me, I don't care what it's about, I hop on the call without question.
Yep.
When you have built the reputation amongst your peers, you have easier access into the accounts you're trying to break into. So that is why I think a peer-led influencer marketing strategy, specifically focused on how do I build influence and trust within my target accounts, is the best low-cost ABM strategy that you can build.
Let's break it down further here. So for the people who are, you know, let's just say they're looking at an influencer program. Now, you could go out and find influencers in the space, right? And that's what a lot of people are doing. You're seeing the Gongs doing that. You're seeing, you know, the Apollos doing that. So from that standpoint, when you're looking at identifying who could be a good influencer for you, what are you keeping in mind?
I want to build them in-house. Yeah. I'm actually not looking to hire.
I love that.
I want to raise up our subject matter experts.
Yep.
And give them a platform. The challenge with that is inevitably they may leave, and that's okay. which is why I'm a huge fan of, to the best of your ability, you start with one. This is a very odd example, but it's the best example that I can think of. And I always come back to it. It's like Ramsey Solutions. So people may or may not know Dave Ramsey. He's a financial guru kind of guy. And he has built a very successful business over 30 or 35 years. But when you look at how he's now built it, as they've been doing legacy planning and transitioning from Dave, Dave is like the core thought leader of Ramsey Solutions. But then underneath Dave, there are people that talk about marriage, there are people talking about mental health, there are people that talk about like millennial money, there are people that talk about building a business, there are people that talk about like getting out of college debt and how to go to college for free, or not for free, but through scholarships. So like you have the core thought leader that is the main advocate and messenger for the brand message. And then you essentially have niche subtopics underneath that. I think an incredible potential play for a marketing agency, and I wrote this out 4 years ago. I have not executed on it, and I should, but it's essentially raising up a main thought leader on a category. And then you have specific vertical thought leaders that, so we'll use Scrappy ABM as an example. I could hire in people and raise them up to be vertical specific experts on how to implement Scrappy ABM in the manufacturing space, in the tech space, in the, actually, we'll just leave it at that example. Sorry, the sour candy is starting to get to my head. All that to say, you can raise it up from an industry vertical perspective. But again, it's all peer-led. It's influencer-led. But again, that influencer hops on the call. People start to freak out because there's already such implicit trust and actually value for the relationship that, and the value that that person has disseminated through the market as a whole.
Let me rewind a little bit, because I loved your answer about saying, like, why are we, you know, why go out and, you know, do an influencer program with, you know, people outside of the company, right? Let's explain to me why would you rather look inside your company besides going out and trying to find, right? Let's, perfect example, Will Atkin. Why not reach out to Will Atkin? Instead, build someone from your team internally.
Two main reasons. One, if it's somebody that's already on the team, they're bought into the vision and the mission of the organization more likely than an influencer that you're outsourcing to. So even though there may be overall alignment from an influencer perspective, because they're owning a specific category, they will not necessarily be brand specific. Like, they're going to be more aligned to their overall mission and vision. And if there's like overlap, awesome. But I would want somebody that can like truly be dedicated to the mission and vision of what we're trying to accomplish. And again, if they're already working in the organization, it's not a guarantee, but it's exponentially more likely.
What are you looking for? What attributes are you looking for when you're looking into your team and you're saying, okay, I want to have, let's just say I want five, you know, influencers out there to build their brand. And what are some attributes?
I wouldn't start with five. I think you need one.
Okay.
I think ideal state, it's actually your founder. I think a founder-led brand is a great way to get started. And if you're already at a significant stage where a founder-led brand does not make sense, then I would want it to be some form of an executive that is the peer. So like our CFO, our COO. So I'm looking at, again, alignment from a vision value perspective. I'm looking at actual hands-on experience that's trust within the industry. Like people, I'll be blunt, like people did not care what I had to say 4 or 5 years ago. Didn't matter in the industry. But I've now done a couple of things and people have seen it, and I've been around long enough and I've got a little bit of a resume that I can show. I've done a few things, just like literally a few. That's all it took. And people actually think I have something to say now, which is cool. Like, not a lot of people, but like, again, that small group of 5,000 actually think I have something valuable to say. So if you just raise up some person that's like really aligned, it's like, I'm all bought in, but they have no practical hands-on experience to earn the respect of an industry, it's not going to work. So you need someone that's bought in from a vision value perspective. You need someone that actually has the resume to validate what they are saying. And then the third and final piece, and you can train and coach this up, is someone that's good actually being engaging as a speaker. I try to be, I know I have a lot of work, but like, I'm a bit lively in my conversations. So I try to be a bit engaging. I try to get excited. I actually love what I'm talking about so much. I don't actually try, like, this is just my natural, this is what I'm doing. So it doesn't feel hard for me to go on podcasting, to do speaking stuff, because I'm genuinely so passionate about what we're doing. And I have the hands-on experience to be able to get into the weeds and the details. So like those would be the three things that I would look at of like, are they value vision aligned? Do they have the hands-on experience? And are they skilled enough to be a speaker that can be engaging and actually engage an audience past just the information, but in the way that they deliver the information?
It's great that you say that because I think if it doesn't resonate with you and you don't have that passion, it comes off very fake, right? And it comes off disingenuous. And I think that, going back, because I know that you said you want to start with a CEO, you want to start with, but as we know, a lot of these older, header, bigger titles, a lot of them didn't grow up in that social media age like we did. And so they're very reluctant to hop on a podcast or because they feel like, okay, is that really a good use of my time? So what I'm seeing, like Gong, a lot of their AEs, right? Brian Lamana or Pollard, right? They're kind of taking that lead themselves as an AE to go out there and make a play. Now, do you think that you start with the CEO, you start with the higher ups, but if you're not able to get there, you want to start to dig deeper, maybe into the lower end and fill that way up?
I hear what you're saying. I think the challenge with the example of Gong is I think Gong has actually done an incredible job on raising people up. Like Devin Reeder, before he transitioned out of Gong, was an AE that transitioned content marketer and then became the face of a lot of their video. Udi transitioned from CMO to chief evangelist. So I think that Gong is an organization that is super bought in on social selling. And as a result, they've created the culture and environment in which their AEs can get out there. Whereas, like, there are other organizations in which I've spoken with leaders. Like even executive leaders that will want to post on LinkedIn and their CEO says, hey, cut that out. And they're like,
True.
I
Yeah.
want to build a personal brand. And a CMO said to me that their CEO said, and I quote, your personal brand is what you're able to accomplish for me. If it's not what you can accomplish for me, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like verbatim. So again, that's why I say it has to start at the top, because if it doesn't, it's going to get squashed almost immediately. And you can't go down into the lower ranks because they're the lower rank conversation. Hold on. We transition on
I hear you.
microphones. Look at my head. Anyway, the lower ranks are not going to get that level of conversation. They're going to just get let go.
It's sad to say, but you're right. And I've experienced that backlash before. And there is something to say about the SaaS companies and companies in general who want to make sure their brand, they have control over their brand, right? And so if an AE is posting and they post something just outrageous and everyone's like, well, I hate that, like that's kind of brings them back to their brand. Like for me, I've been trying to build out an employee advocacy program, but you have to get your leadership on board first, right? So, just to tie this all back together, I'd love for you to just give me a couple heavy hitters when it comes to being scrappy with ABM. If anyone were to leave today, the couple insights that you think would be really important, what would you end the, this podcast on?
The first and most important thing is if you're going to try to build an ABM program, don't Google how do I get started with ABM. Google how does AB or why does ABM fail? Google why does ABM fail? Because that will help you identify what went wrong foundationally as other people have built programs. And again, a lot of these guides have the implicit assumption or the implied assumption that you have the right foundation before you go to build. So don't Google how to get started. Google how why does ABM fail? Then you can fix those things that on why it fails. The number one thing that I found that works really well is a short-term marketing and sales project. There's a 30 to 45-day project where you get buy-in from a seller or a couple of sellers to build a program that gets marketing and sales working together. That's it.
Yep.
And again, what I really, really love, if you can build it around the right trigger. So, like prime example. Build an outbound play that uses a tool called Propensity that is for free, that uses Apollo, which is free, and uses Warmly, which is free. Propensity, third-party intent data on as many topics as you want. You get 100 accounts on a weekly basis. You enrich that account list with Apollo and do outbound sequencing. From there, you then hit them to your website, use Warmly for free to de-anonymize your account level traffic. And then you follow up one to one and try to get those people into a meeting. That is a playbook that you can run today for free. And from there, Once you've actually proven out that model, you can build a larger account-based marketing program where the goal is not just cold intent outbound towards the specific account that we're trying to get to our website, but actually build a fuller funnel ABM program that includes multiple channels that are driving towards these product pricing and demo pages. And then you optimize post-conversion on the actual outbound trigger, which is, again, hitting the demo page. So that is the first part that I just said. That's 30 to 45 days. The next part is 3 to 6 months. And that is how you can build your first ABM program that you could then scale up by investing in the right technology. By the way, all the technology I just said are a product-led growth motion. So you can just literally move up in tier on the technology you already have today to get more access to better channels.
That was a brilliant, brilliant ending right there, Mason. I can't thank you enough for joining me on the show today. Love to ask you, what was your favorite candy that you tried?
Skittles. I mean, it was just
Wow.
like a breeze. And Skittles are the best out of
Worst
this. I mean,
candy?
I'm standing, I'm lightheaded. I'm actually a little bit worried that I'm gonna need to sit down for the rest of the day, which is, that's fun.
Drink some water. That's what I've been doing. But again, I just can't thank you enough. For everyone listening, you can follow Scrappy ABM on LinkedIn, Mason on LinkedIn. They're dropping insights all the time. You can follow my podcast on LinkedIn. Follow me. Make sure to give us a shout out, and we'll be able to show up in the comments. And if you need any help, you know who to go to for Scrappy ABM. So, Mason, thank you so much. It was a pleasure being with you today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. This was awesome.
See you later, man.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scrappy ABM. If you enjoyed this week's episode, go ahead and give us a follow so that you don't miss a single episode. We drop every single Monday so that you can start your week off right. And if you're looking for additional great content just like this, go check out scrappyabm.com. We're building a library of frameworks, guides, templates, processes and tools so you have everything that you need to build a low budget, high impact, scrappy program. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. This has been your host, Mason Cosby, and we look forward to seeing you in the next one.